بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering your doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah who is Ar-Rahman. Allah who is Al-Mannan.
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamun alaikum. Welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs from IRIB English Radio. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi from Islamic House of Qom is ready today to answer today's question. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Imam al-Mahdi, the 12th Shia Imam, is passing life in major occultation, Ghibat al-Kubra. How can the existence of Imam al-Mahdi, a biological body, a person, and his long life be proven according to Islamic traditions and Islamic beliefs, Sheikh Karimi? This is a major question for today. First, let's talk a little bit about existence, and then the long life.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As we all know, the concept of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is shared by all Muslims, both Shia and Sunni. Both denominations believe in the coming of a person called Mahdi, who will fill the earth with justice. So there is no about that. The only question is whether he is born or not. According to our Sunni brothers, they believe that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will be born in future, and at Shia we believe that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is the son of Imam Askari alayhi salam, and he was born in the year 255, and now, as you mentioned, passing life in major occultation. Now, especially recently, there are some questions about the very birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and some have doubted the very birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, especially some Wahhabis. They even have written books to prove that the Shia cannot prove the existence and the very birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So first of all, I would like to talk about different narrations, both mentioned by Shia scholars and then some viewpoints of some Sunni scholars about the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and his very existence. So sometimes some people assume that the narration and the story of the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is just mentioned by Hakima Khatun, and she is the only narrator, and we cannot accept the testimony of a lady. But this is not true.
Okay.
Although, Hakima Khatun is the very lady who was present when Lady Narges was about to give birth to her blessed child, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. We have some narrations, for example, حدثتني حكيمة ابنة محمد ابن علي. We know that Hakima is the daughter of Imam Jawad alayhi salam, the aunt of Imam Askari alayhi salam. أنها رأته ليلة مولده وبعد ذلك. So Hakima Khatun is only one of the people who witnessed Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, not only on that night but also later. But there are many other people who have seen Imam Mahdi alayhi salam when he was a child. We know that for 5 years he was passing life in the minor occultation with his holy father Imam Askari alayhi salam. So many people had this chance to meet Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So to think that it was only Hakima Khatun is a wrong assumption. There are two ladies, Nasim and Maria. They were, servants in the house of Imam Askari alayhi salam. They have mentioned the following, that لما سقط صاحب الزمان عليه السلام من بطن أمه جاثيا على ركبتيه رافعا سبابته إلى السماء ثم عطس. So they narrated a story that when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born, we saw the following, and then they narrated a story and the supplication of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. This is in Kamal al-Din by Sheikh al-Saduq, page 430. We know that one of the special deputies of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam during his minor occultation is Uthman ibn Sa'id.
Yes.
Al-Amri. Sheikh Qurayni narrates the following narration that a person told Uthman ibn Sa'id that Anta ra'ayta al-khalifa min ba'da Abi Muhammad alayhi salam. Did you see the successor after Imam Askari alayhi salam? He said, Iwallah, I swear by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that I saw him. And then he refers to some of the physical features of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. In another narration, we are told about 40 people of the Shia of Imam Askari alayhi salam who were present in his house, and Imam Askari alayhi salam showed them his son, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. It's been mentioned that Muhammad ibn Ayyub bin Nuh and Muhammad ibn Uthman Amri, they say, عرض علينا أبو محمد الحسن بن علي ونحن في منزله. We were in the house of Imam Askari alayhi salam, وكنا أربعين رجلا. We were 40 people. And Imam showed us his son and said, هذا إمامكم من بعدي. This is your Imam after me, وخليفتكم عليكم أتيعوه. You need to obey him.
Ahmad ibn Ishaq al-Qummi is another one who had the chance of meeting him. He was the special deputy of Imam al-Jawad, Imam Hassan al-Askari, Imam al-Hadi, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So when Imam al-Zaman, Imam al-Mahdi was 3 years old, he asked Imam Hassan al-Askari about the Hujjah on earth.
Exactly.
What do you mean by Hujjah? Imam gets in, brings out a 3-year-old child, Imam al-Mahdi, and showed him to him, this is the Hujjah of Allah, okay?
Abu Ghanem is another servant in the house of Imam Askari alayhi salam. He says that when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was only 3 days old, Imam Askari alayhi salam showed him to some of his companions. He said, "Walad al-Abi Muhammad waladun fasammahu Muhammadan." A child was born for Imam Askari alayhi salam. He called him, he named him Muhammad. فعرضه على أصحابه يوم الثالث. On the third day after his birth, the Imam showed him to his companions, saying, "Hada sahibukum min ba'di wa khalifatki alaykum." This is the Imam, your Imam after me, wa huwa al-qa'im, and this is the qa'im that people are waiting for. And so these are some of the people who have seen Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. It's not only limited to Hakim al-Khatun.
Yes.
As I mentioned, only one narration refers to 40 people. And then in some narration, we are told that Imam Askari alayhi salam has told some of his companions that Mahdi has been born. For example, in one narration, Abu Hashim Ja'fari says that I asked Imam Askari alayhi salam that, Ya Sayyidi, hal laka walad? Oh my master, do you have a child? فقال نعم. Imam said, yes. I asked, فَإِنْ حَدَثَ بِكَ حَدَثٌ فَأَيْنَ أَسْعَلُهَمْ. If something happens to you, meaning that if you pass away, where should I look for him? قَالْ بِالْمَدِينَ, in the city of Medina. So in this narration and similar narration, some people may have not seen Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, but they received the news of his birth from Imam Askari alayhi salam. So these are some narrations referring in Shia corpus, referring to the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born, and so many people either saw and met him or heard the news of his birth from Imam Askari alayhi salam.
So, from one side, we want to prove the existence of Imam al-Mahdi, the last Shia Imam and the Savior, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So this is Mahdi al-Ghaib. But from the other side, some people might say that, is it possible, for example, for Imam al-Hasan al-Askari not to have children? I mean, and this was the only son to Imam Hasan al-Askari,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
So being only one child, I think might answer itself lots of questions that why only one child, okay? So one child to Imam Hassan al-Askari and also being the last proof of Allah on earth. So because if there were several children on that time, there might be so many questions that why, for example, the other imams or the other sons will not be the last proof of Allah on earth. So being limited only to one child,
yeah,
I think it is itself a good answer.
Yeah, very good
of
point.
We can't say it being the last point.
And that is why we have Ja'far al-Kadhab, because Imam Askari alayhi salam didn't have any other
sons.
Ja'far al-Kadhab was another person who claimed to be the next Imam, and then he was rejected by Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Yes. Okay.
So these are some narration in Shia sources. As I mentioned, according to Sunni sources, we can also prove the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Mm.
Of course, they do not believe that this is Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, but the point is that many Sunni scholars, they have mentioned in their books that Askari Hassan Askari, who is the 11th Shia Imam, he had a child whose name was Mahdi. So this in and of itself proves that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born. Although they do not believe in Imam Askari alayhi salam to be the 11th Imam. They do not believe in Imam Mahdi alayhi salam to be the promised Mahdi.
But historical fact that he had one
exactly.
son.
Exactly. Historical testimonies of these scholars. For example, Abu al-Fida, who passed away in 732, a scholar of the 8th century after Hijra, he says the following, that he talks about Imam Askari alayhi salam, and then he says, وَهُوَ وَارِدْ مُحَمَّدْ الْمُنْتَظَرِ. He is the father of Muhammad al-Muntadhar, and Muhammad al-Muntadhar huwa thani ashar al-aimmat al-ithna ashar ala ra'y al-imamiyya. So first of all, he proves that Imam Hassan al-Askari al-Salam had a child whose name was Muhammad, and of course he said that this Muhammad is the 12th Imam according to the Shia, who is called al-Qa'im al-Mahdi al-Hujjah. So in and of itself, Abu al-Bada, historically speaking, proves that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born. Ibn al-Wardi, who passed away in 749, another Sunni scholar, he says that وَالْحَسَنُ الْعَسْكَرِ وَالِدُ مُحَمَّدْ الْمُنْتَدَرِ. The same statement. He also proved that Imam Askari alayhi salam had a child whose name was Muhammad. Mm-hmm. His title was Muntadhar. He is the 12th Imam of the Shia. وَيُلَقَّبْ أَيْضًا الْقَائِمْ وَالْمَهْدِي وَالْحُجَّةِ. The Shia calls him with different titles, like Qa'im, Mahdi, and Hujjah. Ibn Hajar, the famous Sunni scholar, who passed away in 973, in his famous book, As-Sawa'iq al-Muhriqa, in which in many cases he criticizes the Shia, he also proves that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born, and Imam Askari alayhi salam had a child. He says, وَلَمْ يُخَلِّفْ غَيْرَ وَلَدِهِ أَبَ الْقَاسِمْ مُحَمَّدْ الْحُجَّةِ. Imam Askari, of course, he does not call him Imam Askari alayhi salam. Yes. Hassan al-Askari did not leave any children except for Abu al-Qasim Muhammad. And وَعُمْرُهُ عَنْدَ وَفَاتَ أَبِيهِ خَمْسُ سَنِينَ. When his father, Imam Askari, passed away, he was only 5 years old. You know that Imam Askari alayhi salam passed and was martyred in 260, and Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born in 255, so he was only 5 years. And Manawi, who passed away in 1031, another Sunni scholar, he quotes from Bastami that talks about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, even his mother, وَأَمَّا أُمُّهُ فَإِسْمُهَا نَرْجِسِ. He even refers to the name of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, which is Narjis. So these are some historical testimonies by Sunni scholars. As I mentioned, unfortunately, nowadays even we see among some Shia who may doubt the historicality of the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. As I mentioned, not only in the Shia sources, but according to Sunni scholars of Hadith and history, for sure Imam Askari alayhi salam had a child. He was born in 255. And no one can doubt about the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Shaykh, you said that some of our Sunni brethren believe that Imam Mahdi will be born later, isn't it?
Yeah.
So is it clear from who is the father and mother?
The name of the father of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, according to some, to Sunni scholars, they refer to, there are two viewpoints here. Some of them, they believe that he is from the generation of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, and some believe that he is from the generation of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. So this is what is mentioned in Sunni narrations, is that for sure he is one of the offspring of Fatima al-Zahra salamun alayha. This is for sure. But whether he is from the offspring of Imam Hassan or Imam Hussein alayhi salam, there are conflicting narrations in Sunni sources.
So the parents are alive. You mean generation after generation?
Yeah, and
the later generation?
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Sheikh, for proving the existence of Imam al-Mahdi as the son of Imam al-Hassan al-Askari. You know, it was very kind of you. So historically speaking, according to historical facts, Imam Hassan al-Askari is the father, Najas Khatun, who is believed to be from the Roman lineage, isn't it?
According to one narration,
is the mother. And he is passing life in major occultation. There are still so many questions for the long life of the Imam. Let's shift it to the other discussion, inshallah. Thank you very much for this episode. Thank you much, dear listeners. For more information, visit our website, iranradio.ir. Also send us your questions and emails to englishradio@sinarabia.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper-thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the hall of shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history. Should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. The thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? Be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too
ocean of dua.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters in faith, dear listeners of RIB English Radio. You're listening to the Ocean of Dua. In the recent episodes of this program, we've been discussing and analyzing the supplication of Sabah. Let's listen to the passage of this dua and we'll be right back.
النفس والشيطان فقد وكلني خذلانك إلى حيث النصب والحرمان إلهي أتراني ما أتيتك إلا من حيث الآمال أم علقت بأطراف حبالك إلا حين
Okay, the passage that we just listened to from the supplication of Sabah states, وَإِنْ خَذَلَنِي نَصْرُكَ عِنْدَ مُحَارَبَةِ النَّفْسِ وَالشَّيْطَانِ فَقَدْ وَكَلَنِي خِذْلَانُكَ إِلَى حَيْثُ النَّصَبِ وَالْحِرْمَانِ. How beautiful and how poetic these passages are. Okay? If your help should forsake me in the battle against the soul and Satan, then your forsaking will have submitted me to where there is hardship and deprivation. Okay? We're all fighting our nafs, our carnal soul, our carnal desire, and Satan. Now, because you know, Satan and his minions, shayateen, what they do is that they entice us, they encourage us to commit sins, and they try to have control over us. Okay? But if we strengthen ourselves, if we rely on Allah, we will be able to resist their temptations. And that is what Allah has said in the Quran. Inna kayda shaytana kana dha'ifa. The stratagem of Satan is weak. The tricks and the trickeries and the cunnings of Satan, they are weak. If we strengthen ourselves, yes, if we are weak ourselves, then they will overcome us. So here, we are asking Allah to strengthen us, to make us able to battle against both the nafs, the soul, and Satan. Because if Allah does not help us, then we're going to have a really, really hard time. And we'll be deprived of many good things if Allah does not come to our help. So, you know, this supplication is showing how much we are reliant on Allah, how much we are dependent on Allah. Everything that we have is from Allah. Nothing is from us ourselves, okay? So if we see that we are on this path, if we are guided, if we have love for the Prophet and his Ahlul Bayt, if we are able to resist this temptations of Satan and his minions, these are all due to the husn al-tawfiq that we talked about in the previous episode. Okay? So it's important that we seek help from Allah to help us fight Satan and the soul. Let's take a break and we'll be right back.
If your help should forsake me in the battle against the soul and Satan, then your forsaking will have submitted me to where there is hardship and deprivation. My God, do you see that I have only come to you from the direction of hopes, or clung to the ends of your cords when my sins have driven me from the house of union?
Thank you, Allah, that we're here feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
Okay, the next passage of the supplication of Sabah reads, Ilahi, أتراني ما أتيتك إلا من حيث الآمال أم علقت بأطراف حبالك إلا حين باعدتني ذنوبي عن دار الوصال. My God, do you see that I have only come to you from the direction of hopes, or clung to the ends of your cords when my sins have driven me from the house of union? So the thing is that we have two concepts in Islam that are very fundamental. One is khawf, one is raja. Khawf means fear. Fear of Allah's punishment. Fear of failure. Okay? And then we have raja, which is hope. Hope in Allah's mercy. Hope that Allah will help us, will guide us. Okay, we have been told that this khawf and raja, fear and hope, they should be the same, of the same weight. If you put khawf on one end of the scale and raja on another end, they should be equal. One should not be heavier than the other. So now, this passage is talking about wasal, dar al-wasal. What is that? Wasal means achieving something, you know, like achieving prosperity in the sense of seeing Allah, meeting Allah, encountering Allah. This is the wasal. Being united with Allah. This is what union is in the term, you know, in the sense of mysticism. When we say wisal, we mean union with Allah. So here the supplicant is saying that I have many hopes. I have come to you from the direction of hopes, and I have clung to the ends of your cords when my sins have driven me from the house of union. So we are all trying to, you know, rely on Allah, ask Allah to help us, that we might be actually failing, we might be drowning, and this is when we all scream for Allah's help. Oh Allah, help us, I'm drowning, help me, I want to be united with you, I'm not satisfied with this state that I am in right now. Okay, and this is what this passage is trying to say, is that we all have hope in being united with Allah. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Ocean of Dua. Until next time, I leave you in the care and protection of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Guide me all the way to your Jannah. Yeah, Allah, yeah, Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close, close to you throughout my life. Yeah, Allah, oh, Allah.
Iranian culture. Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we provide an in-depth analysis of the Zionist entity's criminal behavior and the effort it puts into influencing international policymakers and global public opinion. In today's show, we're returning to Jeffrey Epstein's role as an asset of the Zionist colony, following the revelations contained in the latest tranche of emails released by the United States House Oversight Committee in November. Taken in conjunction with a raft of hacked emails from the former Israeli Prime Minister, they illustrate the extent of Epstein's role, as Latifa Abouchaka will explain in our first report.
Jeffrey Epstein's emails shows he has various connections and interests related to Africa, including organizing meetings for prominent figures with African leaders, discussing potential business deals with Zionist intelligence agency-connected firms. Epstein helped to orchestrate meetings for former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak with high-level officials from Côte d'Ivoire, including the Chief of Cabinet for President Ouattara, Sidi Timoko Touré. This effort reportedly bore fruit with a formal bilateral defense and internal security agreement between Israel and Côte d'Ivoire in 2014. The Zionists had, though, been supplying arms to Côte d'Ivoire for years. Since 2004, during the country's first civil war, Côte d'Ivoire had been subject to a UN arms embargo, and in April 2013, the UN Security Council reported the discovery of dozens of crates of Israeli ammunition at the presidential palace and the Atakol naval base, with Israel Military Industries labels and Spanish markings. It was reported that the ammunition had been relabeled and retransferred to Côte d'Ivoire from a third country. In May 2013, Ehud Barak called the honorary consul of Côte d'Ivoire in Israel, Michael Mickey Federman, chairman of Elbit Systems. Elbit had supplied military helicopters to Côte d'Ivoire during the first Ivorian civil war. Dropsite has reported that Epstein and Barak worked together as a conduit for Israel's intelligence sector in Côte d'Ivoire, where Barak was welcomed as a representative of the Israeli government even after leaving public office. Epstein helped Barak deliver a proposal for mass surveillance of Ivorian phone and internet communications, crafted by former Israeli intelligence officials. In September 2013, the details of Israel's offer to the West African country arrived in Barak's inbox from Aaron Zevi Farkash, former head of Israeli military intelligence from 2002 to 2006, and a veteran of Unit 8200 for SIGINT, Signals Intelligence Organization in Côte d'Ivoire. The document, a 13-page PDF, mapped out the complete architecture for eavesdropping on phone calls, satellites, tactical radio, and special targets like cyber cafes. The data streams flowed to media processing servers to be reviewed by analysts, then synthesized into reports for security leaders. By June 2014, Avigdor Lieberman, Israel's Minister of Foreign Affairs arrived in Côte d'Ivoire to sign an agreement on defense and internal security, accompanied by more than 50 businessmen who came to evaluate prospective investments in the country. The Epstein emails and a hacked collection of Ehud Barak's emails inbox highlight how Epstein leveraged his network and financial influence to connect powerful people, explore business deals, and pursue Zionist military and intelligence interests. They show both the deeply embedded connections of Epstein to Zionist intelligence priorities and the emerging influence of the Zionist state in an area of the world far removed from West Asia.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyn University. And joining us once again as our guest contributor today is an American author, political commentator, and human rights activist, Dan Kovalik. His latest book, The Case for Palestine, that was published last year, is a must-read treatise that explains why everyone should care about what happens in Palestine. Welcome to the show. David, listening to Latifa's report there, it seems that Jeffrey Epstein and Israel's former Prime Minister Ehud Barak were as thick as thieves, weren't they? I mean, what's your take on how they were involved in this intrigue?
Well, the interesting thing to start pulling on the thread is that Barak was involved in this after he was Minister of Defence, after he was Prime Minister. He was still regarded and accepted by his interlocutors as being an official representative of the Zionist regime, and also so was Epstein. So this is an indication of the way in which these deals are done, that the formal positions that people have are not really necessarily any guide. So the people who supplied the PDF about the signals intelligence proposal, they're not supposed to give it to people who are not formally part of the regime, and they're not supposed to give it, weren't supposed to give it to the Ivory Coast. But of course, because of the way in which these things work, that was just seen as normal. And that's the way all the way through the Epstein affair, actually. I mean, Epstein worked out of Les Wexler's house, which Wexler then gave to him, cost $50-odd million. But he was supposed to not be involved at all with Wexler's foundation, but the emails show that actually he was intimately involved even after he was supposed to have resigned.
Interesting indeed. Well, Dan, I mean, Barak seems to have been very close to Epstein and was filmed even trying to disguise himself, leaving Epstein's New York apartment. I mean, what did you make of their relationship?
Well, I mean, I think they were co-collaborators. They were both working in the interests of Israel on a number of projects, including, as you mentioned, in Côte d'Ivoire. I think even deeper, the more that one thinks about it, it's not just on behalf of Israel, but I think in general on behalf of the West. I think Israel, what you're seeing in Africa is they're doing the dirty work that the other Western countries can't do, right? Like giving guns to Côte d'Ivoire when there's an arms embargo against it, right? Giving surveillance to the government there to gain the upper hand in a civil war, all to, you know, extract the very rich resources of that country. And again, Epstein and Barak were partners in crime in those efforts.
Well, David, how did Epstein come to have those contacts then in the Ivory Coast or with the Ivory Coast?
Well, he had all sorts of contacts. He had contacts in the academic world, he had contacts in the finance world, and he had contacts amongst, what should we say, a network of paedophiles and child traffickers, right? So a lot of contacts. And of course those contacts overlap with each other. Now, in the case of Côte d'Ivoire, he had known since 2002 a young model from the Ivory Coast who was actually the niece of the current president of the Ivory Coast. And so she had travelled on the Lolita Express. And in this process of trying to pitch for these intelligence contracts in the Ivory Coast, she was involved in meetings with Epstein, as well as Barak having meetings with the president and the advisors to the president. So those worlds all intersect with each other. So it's not clear whether she was raped and abused by Epstein or his people, but she was traveled on the Lolita Express, and that's an indication really that, that those worlds are very, very interconnected.
One is weaved a very tangled web, isn't it, for sure. But Dan, I mean, that detail in our film about the chairman of Elbit Systems being the honorary consul of the Ivory Coast in Israel, it's pretty remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of bizarre. I mean, you have an Israeli representing Cote d'Ivoire in Israel, right? It just shows how much Israel came to dominate that country, again, through these arms deals, through the helicopters provided, through the intelligence system set up, a really intelligence apparatus that Israel set up in Cote d'Ivoire. Cote d'Ivoire really becomes a almost a neo-colony of Israel. And again, it's shown by the fact that they would have a consul who's Israeli in Israel.
I mean, not just the Greater Israel project then in the immediate sort of region, but the Zionist influence seeking to spread its wings, much, much further afield, doesn't it indicate that from what we've been...
Well, absolutely. It's global. And again, particularly in Africa, which is a country that's been very dominated, obviously, by the West. Its resources have been plundered, and Israel has played a key role there. And again, I emphasize that Israel, they come in to support countries that no one else can do openly. You know, one of the most, of course, egregious examples of this was South Africa itself, which Israel supported to the bitter end, apartheid South Africa, after even it became embarrassing for the United States to do that. We saw that even in Guatemala, right? Israel supported the military, brutal military regime there, again, when the U.S. openly could not do it. So it extends even beyond Africa into Latin America. Colombia as well, the head of the paramilitary death squads, Carlos Castaño, said he owed his life and country to Israel. So, I mean, they have their tentacles everywhere.
Sure, no, absolutely. Of course, we should remember that, Africa is a huge continent, not just a country as well. But David, can you say a bit more, will you, about this deal made with the Ivory Coast to set up cyber security and spying operations in the country?
So this is the modus operandi of the Zionist entity, isn't it? That they use their intelligence services to create intelligence products, which they then sell to other countries, in this case, the Ivory Coast. Whereas, and then what happens, of course, is that there's always, and has been from the 50s, a back door put into these by the Mossad, by Unit 8200. I mean, one of the first was one which was in which Robert Maxwell was a Mossad agent who was involved. And they then sold that software to a number of intelligence agencies around the world. And there was a back door, and that's, of course, the purpose. They sell these products, the companies from the entity which are staffed by former Israeli intelligence operatives, make the money, but then Zionist intelligence agencies have a back door into the security apparatus of the country. In the case of Ivory Coast, that's true, and in case of many other countries. And there's no other way of saying this than that this is actually about pursuing Zionist interests. Like they do it in America as well. They've actually also penetrated American intelligence and bugged the White House. And if it was the case they were doing this on behalf of the U.S., then they wouldn't be doing that.
Okay. Well, Dan, I mean, what's your assessment of the role played by Epstein in promoting Israel's influence in the Ivory Coast?
Well, again, it seems like he was very critical in that at a time when the country, when the government was in a very tenuous position because of a contested election, and the country was either in civil war or on the verge of civil war. He kind of swooped in to help, apparently at least to broker deals with weapons, with intelligence, to secure that government. And that allowed Israel to have incredible influence in that country.
our next report discloses the extent of Jeffrey Epstein's role in promoting the Zionist colony's interests in Africa.
Jeffrey Epstein appears to have been much more involved in pursuing Zionist interests in Africa than had previously been known. Epstein had multiple U.S. passports and even an Austrian passport with a fake name he reportedly obtained to travel internationally, though he denied using it. As early as 2001, Epstein was recorded as visiting Morocco with a decorator to visit a house there. In 2017 and 2019, he returned for brief trips. Morocco has regularly and extensively cooperated with the Zionists for decades prior to normalization in 2020. The New York Times states the two countries have worked together closely but secretly on military and intelligence matters, assassinations, and migration of Jews to Israel. In the early 1960s, King Hassan allowed Mossad to establish a station in Morocco. Mossad then helped organize the Moroccan intelligence service. Testimony from Ghislaine Maxwell confirmed that former President Bill Clinton had traveled on Epstein's private jet on reported humanitarian trips to Africa. In around August 2002, Epstein, Clinton, Kevin Spacey, and Chris Tucker spent a week on a tour of AIDS projects in South Africa, Nigeria, Ghana, Rwanda, and Mozambique. In a 2011 letter requesting a second U.S. passport, Epstein listed future business trips to Sierra Leone, Mali, and Gabon. It is also reported that he visited Senegal and Angola, as well as Cote d'Ivoire. There seems little doubt that some of these trips were intended to pursue Zionist foreign policy priorities. All of these states are, of course, in West Africa, and all have a coastal border, with the exception of Mali. The recent disclosures about Epstein have confirmed earlier statements which were widely regarded with skepticism. Epstein had bragged he had made a fortune from arms, drugs, and diamonds because he knew the owner of the deepwater port of Djibouti, a smuggler's paradise, so well that he was basically in charge of it. Recently released emails confirmed this was the CEO of DP World, an Emirati state asset. Evidence from Ghislaine Maxwell gives further corroboration. "He showed me a photograph that he had with some African warlords," she said. Given that we know that Zionist special forces have access to DP World sites and the role of both the UAE and the Zionists in multiple African nations, it begins to look like an Africa-wide network. DP World has facilities and ports in Africa and the following countries visited by Epstein: Angola, Mozambique, Rwanda, and Senegal. There is no concrete evidence that Epstein visited DP World sites in Algeria, Egypt, or Somaliland. These revelations suggest new lines of inquiry for those seeking to fully understand Epstein's role in the expansionist foreign policy of the Zionist entity.
Well, David, I mean, we've just heard in our report there that Epstein had links in Morocco. I mean, why do you think Morocco's been so close to the Zionist entity, even before the normalization process started?
Well, I mean, as we heard from the film there, I mean, the very early collaboration between King Hassan and the Mossad is a note. I mean, the Mossad had a station there, but the Mossad actually set up the Moroccan intelligence agencies. And when it came to the operation that Mossad launched to kidnap Jewish kids to get them to come to the settler colony, that was accomplished with aid from the Moroccan intelligence services, which effectively were Mossad assets. And it was in a particular case, these kids were about to leave and were stopped at the port by the police, and the intelligence services intervened and allowed the children to leave, and they were effectively kidnapped and taken to Israel to become settler colonies. So it's a long, long history of collaboration, and it shows the kind of way in which the Mossad would want to use their involvement in a particular country. You see a very similar thing in the Ivory Coast and in a number of other African countries which we've looked at. So it does look like they are trying to take over and use as assets the intelligence machinery of a number of different countries.
Well, Dan, it appears that Epstein made multiple trips to various African countries. I mean, what do you think he was up to?
Well, I think that he was helping broker various arms and intelligence deals with these countries, again, in an effort to be able to exploit these countries' resources. You know, Israel's very much involved in the diamond trade, for example, but they don't have, as far as I know, diamond mines themselves. They're getting them from Africa. And again, Epstein helped facilitate that through these efforts. And if I could add something about Morocco, the other interest that Morocco has had with Israel is that Morocco is illegally occupying West Sahara. And you have Algeria, who's supporting liberation forces there. And Israel has helped Morocco in that effort of occupation and against the liberation forces supported by Algeria, which, again, makes sense for one occupying country, Israel, to be supporting another. Kind of birds of a feather there.
Yeah, indeed. Curious hookup, to say the least. But, David, I mean, Epstein bragged, didn't he, about making a fortune from arms, drugs and diamonds in Africa. I mean, was that the main purpose, do you think, of these activities?
Well, no, obviously it's not the main purpose, but as Dan was saying, I mean, the diamonds is an interesting one, because of course they were, you know, the implication was they were smuggled out via Djibouti, but the diamond, of course, there are no diamond mines in occupied Palestine. They're in the Democratic Republic of Congo, and that's where the concessions for diamonds there are owned by Zionists. We did a program about this some months ago. And so that's an indication of that link, that the smuggling route was out through Djibouti, and that's how Israel manages to be one of the largest diamond producers in the world. I mean, truly extraordinary. So it's an indication that Epstein had a key role even in that, and that shows the way in which he was effectively, even by doing business on behalf of the Zionist entity itself. So that's one thing. And the other thing, of course, is that there's all the foreign policy interests which go along with this one.
Well, Dan, I mean, given the role of the Zionists in bugging the Clinton White House and making or obtaining recordings of Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, would you say that this puts a whole new spin on Epstein's trips to Africa with Clinton?
Well, absolutely. First of all, what it shows is that Epstein, as he seems to have over Trump, he had a hold over Clinton, that he was most likely blackmailing Clinton and able to affect Clinton's policies, especially towards Israel. But yeah, these trips then to Africa makes one wonder, were they purely humanitarian, or was he using Clinton again to gain access to these countries, to gain access to resources and business deals for Israel? And most likely that is what he was doing. Again, what Epstein seems to have done, in addition to many things, this was a pretty busy guy, but he was running a blackmail scheme, which again allowed him to have domination over many U.S. politicians, even from the grave, even over Donald J. Trump.
Seems that way, Dan, for sure. But David, do you think his links with the multinational logistics company, DP World, indicate that the Zionist penetration of Africa is much more extensive than we may have thought?
Well, the other week we did a show on Somaliland, where DP World has a port very close to Yemen, which of course is used as a hub by the UAE and by the Zionists for attacking Ansarawa, so if you like, from the back. So that, yes, of course, that's the case. And then DP World has these hubs all the way around the coast of Africa, including one which is inland, which is in Rwanda, the only one without a coastal border. And so the smuggling happens there. But also the Israeli Special Forces and the Mossad have access to these ports as well, yeah, because the UAE is a proxy. So this means that there's a much greater ability for Mossad to operate all over Africa than we have anticipated.
Well, Dan, very briefly, because we're almost out of time, what questions should we be asking about Epstein's role in Africa then, do you think?
Well, we need to ask what he was doing exactly for Israel, what interests he was pursuing there. Again, was he, I think it's very clear, he wasn't acting is an individual. He was acting on behalf of the state of Israel, perhaps for Mossad, because we know he did have those connections with Mossad. And it also, we have to ask again, me as an American, I have to ask, what role was he playing in influencing U.S. policy in Africa as well? Again, through these so-called humanitarian flights. He seemed to have a sway over people and over states that was extraordinary.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today, so I'd like to thank our guest, Dan Kovalik. Make a date to join us again on Palestine Declassified next week, when I'll be back alongside David Miller with more revelations and information that you won't find on the corporate media. But until then, this is Chris Williamson saying,